Parshas Vayakhel en Pekudei, page 516. So, it's a big Shabbos for Shabbos. First of all, it's a double Parsha, Vayakhel en Pekudei.
Is
there
a leap year next week?
It certainly is. Everything's so early. It's got to be a next leap year next week.
It seems like we haven't had one for a
while. Yeah. It's normally every 2 years or every 3 years. This time it was 3 years. So, next year we've got to do better.
Is it 19 or 9 and 17?
It's 7 leap years and 19 years. So we've got a bit of catching up to do next year. So.
You
know, the system works. It's just that, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no.
What happens is when it's a 3 year gap, then the last year before the leap year, the Yom Tov were all very early in the secular calendar. Yeah, so that's why, because next year's a leap year and we haven't had one for 3 years. That's why Purim was the end of February. It's hardly ever. Which is very, very near. But that's because we're a bit out, so that's why next year we'll make it up with a leap year. Where are you rushing to? What's the rush?
You know,
everyone's always rushing. Let's get it out of the way, and then there's the next thing you're going to get out of the way. Just enjoy, you know? Okay. So, as I said, this week is it's Vayakhel Pekudei. It's also Shabbos Mevarchim Nisan. And it's also the last of the four special parshiyos. Right? Around this year, we have four special portions. You know, that we read two before Purim, two after Purim. And this week is the last one, and I want to focus a little bit on that as well. Okay. And as usual, we always find a connection between the Parsha and the things that are happening, so we'll tie that all together, hopefully. So Vayakhel Pekudei is a very interesting Parsha. It doesn't always come together. This year it does. Where it deals once again with the Mishkan. And what's interesting is that the Torah doesn't normally do this, but the Torah almost repeats the whole story of the Mishkan all over again, meaning that in the Torah what we have is we have the commandment the way it was given from Hashem to Moshe Rabbeinu, and then there's the commandment how it was given from Moshe Rabbeinu to the Jewish people, how it was communicated, right? So when we had the parasha Truma and Tetzaveh and the beginning of Kisisa, which is all to do with the vessels of the Mishkan, the structure of the Mishkan, the priestly garments, etc., and culminating in the mitzvah of Shabbos, which was last week's parasha, the beginning of Kisisa. Now we have it all again. Moshe Rabbeinu gathers the Jewish people and he gives them the whole instruction, but we have a repetition. It doesn't normally happen that way. Normally we just have it once and then we assume that that's what happened. Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to the Jewish people. But the Mishkan, partly because of its importance and its significance, we have it all repeated. So let's have a look at and that's why you'll see in the Vayakhel Pekudei there's very little Rashi. Right, it's a very long parasha, there's very little Rashi because he says he's explained it all already. Because it's very much of it is very, very repetitious, which is interesting for the Torah to do that. So let's have a look at the first couple of psukim. Vayakhel Moshe, and Moshe Rabbeinu gathered his kol hadas b'nei Yisrael, all the Jewish people. Vayomer aleihem, and he said to them, Eile hadavarim, these are the things asher tziva Hashem la'asos oisam, that Hashem commanded to do them. So he's going to give them the instruction of the Mishkan, but what he's also going to do is, he's going to instruct them with the mitzvah of Shabbos, because that's what Hashem did. Mishkan and Shabbos come together. Yeah? He says, Sheishas yamim te'osem alocha. 6 years, 6 days, sorry. Work shall be done. Uvayom hashvi yilachem kodesh Shabbos shabbosin la'ashem. 6 days a week work shall be done. The seventh day should be holy. Holy Shabbos to Hashem. So then it says, you shall not burn fire in all of your dwelling places on the day of Shabbos. And then he continues with the Mishkan. There's a number of things to understand. First of all, just very briefly, I spoke about it on Shabbos. Chayavida on Shabbos? It's just very briefly. Sorry? Yeah? You sure? Just let me repeat a word. Just first of all, to talk about the connection between Shabbos and the Mishkan. Because what's interesting, it seems to be with great emphasis that Hashem connects the Mishkan with Shabbos, Just the only difference is, we'll soon talk about it, the difference is that the first time around, we have the commandment of the Mishkan followed by the commandment of Shabbos. When Moshe Rabbeinu gathers the Jewish people, does it the other way around. He says, this is the mitzvah of Shabbos, and then the Mishkan. But in both times, Shabbos and the Mishkan are connected, right? So just very briefly, I spoke about it on Shabbos, why that is. What's the connection between Shabbos and the Mishkan? Apart from the obvious halachic connection, and that is that we actually learn what you're not supposed to do on Shabbos from the Mishkan, right? The Mishkan had 35 principal activities that was involved in order to construct the Mishkan, and those are the 39 prohibited activities that we're not supposed to do on Shabbos, called the Lamed Tes Melachos. But apart from that, there's a deeper connection, and it's explained by the Maariv HaShemesh, and he explains like this. He says, we know that the Mishkan came, we know that the Mishkan was given to atone for the golden calf, right? That was the primary purpose of the Mishkan. The Jews invested all that gold and to construct an idol, a golden calf. They now had to invest the energy to actually increase and emphasize and strengthen their connection to Hashem by building a sanctuary for Hashem, which was, in fact, an atonement for the sin of the Chetah Egel, right? For that sin of the golden calf. So he explains that every transgression has two parts. You have the action, and you have the mindset, the attitude, the will, the desire that goes with it. Okay? And the truth is that I connected with another verse that with the Egel Azov, with the golden calf, we find this with great emphasis, that there's these two parts of the Avera. That's true with every action that a person does. There's the behavior, and then there's the attitude that comes with it, but with the golden calf, it's with great emphasis. And that's found in a vert of last week's parasha where we find that Moshe Rabbeinu came down the mountain and he smashed the luchas, right? He smashed the tablets. Why did he smash the tablets? So it says there in the pasuk that Moshe Rabbeinu came down the mountain, he saw the Jewish people serving the golden calf, and he smashed the tablets. He was coming down with the Ten Commandments. He saw what they were doing and he smashed the luchas. So the commentaries raise a question that Moshe Rabbeinu did not become aware that the Jewish people were serving the golden calf when he came down the mountain. He was already aware of it beforehand. Because the pasuk says clearly that when the Jews served the golden calf, Hashem turned to Moshe Rabbeinu on the mountain when he was in Shamayim, and he told him, you better go down, your people have messed up. And it was right then and there that Hashem was angry. Hashem wanted to destroy the Jewish nation. Moshe Rabbeinu davened on the Jewish people's behalf. Right? So Moshe Rabbeinu was fully aware of the failing of the Jewish nation. Yet, he still comes down the mountain with the tablets, with the luchos. He doesn't smash them. It's only when he gets there and he sees what's actually happening that he decides to smash the luchos. For whatever reason, why smash the luchos, separate discussion. But that's when he does it, right? Now, with human beings, you could always apply the principle of seeing is believing, and that's why he smashed it there. But that's not true with Hashem. Obviously, he was believed before, because Hashem was the one who told him. It wasn't like he didn't doubt that they'd served the Egel Azov. He knew that they'd served the Egel Azov because Hashem had told him. Right? So I once saw a vart to explain this, a very beautiful and very fundamental vart, actually. If you look carefully in the pasuk of last week's parasha where it says that Moshe Rabbeinu came down and he saw them serving the Egel Azov, it doesn't say he saw the calf only. It says like this. It says he came down the mountain, he came close to the camp. Vayar es ha'egel, he saw the calf. And the dancing. Right? Very, very important. He saw the dancing. So what's the difference? The difference is like this. He knew that they'd served the golden calf. But he thought that they failed, because people fail sometimes because they have weakness. People give in to the Yetzer Hara. People give in to the evil inclination. People give in to their temptation. But most times when people give in and do things that they shouldn't do, most times people engage in destructive behavior, they're not happy about it. Most people are unhappy, actually. Most people are unhappy when they just sort of can't hold themselves back. They have a problem with self-control. They fail. They fail intellectually or behaviorally, whatever the case is. Right? So Moshe Rabbeinu could handle that. He could handle the Jewish people failing, even the failing at the greatest level of the Egel Azov. And he wasn't prepared to break the luchos. He davened for us. He pleaded for us, etc., etc. Then the pasuk says when Moshe Rabbeinu comes back, comes close to the camp, Payaras, the eagle, he saw the calf. But he didn't only see the calf. He saw the dancing. He saw the attitude. He saw the simcha, the joy in the Avera. That was too much for him to handle. That he said, now we're in trouble. Now we're in big trouble. They're not just failing, but they're happy about failing. It's a whole hashkafa, it's a whole outlook, it's a whole attitude. They're actually enjoying the process, they're actually getting involved and really relishing the moment of failure. Now we're in big trouble. And he smashed the luchos. And then he went back and still pleaded on our behalf. But at that moment was a whole new revelation, a whole new dimension to the Aveira. So every Aveira, every transgression has the action and has the mindset that goes with it. With the Egel Azov, it was with great emphasis that they actually not only made the Egel Azov, not only took gold and turned it into an idol, but actually had a whole desire, a whole mindset that came with it. Yeah? No, he was very sad. He had tried, Aaron had tried. No. I didn't actually go into the Egel Azov that much last week. The Aaron actually, we talked about Shabbos more last week, but Aaron actually tried to, he tried a strategy that didn't work, essentially. He actually tried to join them. He was kind of played like he was onside in order to get them, to engage in delay tactics. And he gave them all kinds of instructions, because he saw he wouldn't beat them. So he saw you want to egg on Azov, so bring the stones, but do it slowly, and bring the jewelry. Anyway, it all didn't work. It happened much, because he hoped, he knew what the mistake was. He thought in the meantime, it'll take so long, construction will take a while, and then in the meantime, Moshe Rabbeinu will come back. But it didn't happen. Again, the same idea, because the Jews didn't just serve the egg on Azov. They served with enthusiasm. They were so enthusiastic about it, they were so excited about it, that it happened instantaneously. It happened quickly. Right? And that's the problem. So therefore the Shem Yishmul says like this. Therefore, when it came time for an atonement, right, Hashem gave two mitzvahs. One is building a Mishkan, and the second is Shabbos, and they come hand in hand. Because building a Mishkan atones for the action of the golden calf. Shabbos atones for the mindset. Why? Because building a Mishkan is behavioral. It's about taking resources. It's about taking physical objects. And instead of investing them in the wrong place to make an Egel Azov, you make a Mishkan out of it. You make a sanctuary of Hashem. So you build a physical structure to be a place where Hashem's presence can be revealed. So that's physical, that's action, behavioral based. And that atoned for the Egel Azov. But it atoned for the action, not for the mindset. To atone for the mindset, for the excitement, for the enthusiasm that they had put into disconnecting from Hashem, he gave them the mitzvah of Shabbos. Because Shabbos, that's what Shabbos in essence is. Shabbos is a time of spiritual elevation. Shabbos is a time where a Jew stops making, he stops creating, in order to focus spiritually on connection to Hashem, in order to strengthen our emunah. That's what Shabbos is. Shabbos is a day of faith. It's a day of emunah. Shabbos is a day where we're supposed to put ourselves in a whole different mind, frame of mind, right? It's a spiritual experience. And that's why Shabbos atones for the mindset, yeah.
Does that imply that before this, Shabbos wasn't really in the making? Like,
okay, that's a great question. Then no, it doesn't apply that. It doesn't mean that. In fact, Shabbos was given with the Ten Commandments. Shabbos was a mitzvah anyway.
And in the very beginning, like, they had to wait till in Gan Eden.
Shabbos. Shabbos was there, because Shabbos is an essential thing. Shabbos was always there. The question is, what it means that Hashem sort of regave the Shabbos is, he says, if you want an atonement for the Egel Azov, you need to strengthen your connection to Shabbos. So Shabbos, you're right. Shabbos was given on the day of Shavuos when Hashem gave the Ten Commandments. But then he gave it again. It was given again in Kisisan. It's repeated a few times in the Torah. So it's a good point. In other words, not that the whole creation of Shabbos was to atone for the Egel Azov. It's the instruction that Hashem gives us to strengthen the Shabbos, particularly in relation to building the Mishkan. Like Hashem says, build a Mishkan, but on Shabbos don't build a Mishkan. Make sure you're not building, make sure you're focusing on the Shabbos. So it's the strengthening of Shabbos, the adherence to Shabbos, the emphasis of Shabbos, that's the atonement of Egel Azov, right? Okay, so that's the, and that's what we have nowadays also, because the Sfasema says that nowadays we have the same thing. We also have the Mishkan on Shabbos, because we're still atoning for the Egel Azov, right? Because the Sfasema explains that the Mishkan is like the 6 days of creation. What do we do during the 6 days? During the 6 days, we engage in work. What's the purpose of that work? The purpose ultimately is that whatever we do during the 6 days should be turned into a Mishkan, right? We're still building the Mishkan. In other words, during the week we actually do engage in physical activity, but the physical activity has a purpose. The purpose is if we make money, if we cook, if we do things, that it's all in order to strengthen our connection to Hashem, is to bring the Shekhinah, to bring the divine presence into the world, right? So we do the same thing. During the 6 days of every week, we build a Mishkan, which means we engage in physical activity with the purpose of making a dwelling place for Hashem. Shabbos, we stop working. Shabbos is a time to re-energize and to recharge the batteries on a spiritual level. Shabbos, we don't engage in physical activity. Shabbos, we're not building a Mishkan for Hashem. But Shabbos, we're working on our mind. Shabbos, we're working on our outlook. And that's why the two mitzvahs come together, the mitzvah of Mishkan and Shabbos, right? But as I said before, what's interesting is that the first time this comes around, the mitzvah of the Mishkan is given first, and then the mitzvah of Shabbos. The second time it comes around, the mitzvah of Vayakal Pekuda, this week's parasha, Shabbos is given first, and then the Mishkan. Why is that? Because there's two levels of Shabbos. You see, it's interesting that when the first time the Mishkan is given, it's Hashem's commandment to Moshe Rabbeinu, right? The second time it comes around, this week's parasha, it's Moshe Rabbeinu's commandment to the Jewish people. Now, you find the exact same thing in the beginning of creation. At the beginning of creation, Hashem created 6 days and then gave us Shabbos. Correct? So 6 days came before Shabbos. When Adam Arishon was created, Adam and Chava were created, they were created late Friday afternoon. So their first experience was Shabbos, followed by the 6 days. Right? So you have the same thing over here. When Hashem is giving the instruction of the Mishkan, which represents the 6 days of the week, comes before Shabbos. When Moshe Rabbeinu is communicating the instruction of the Mishkan to us, it's the human experience where Shabbos comes first, and then the 6 days of the week. Right? And in truth, in every Shabbos you have both aspects. Right? We know that on the one hand, the 6 days are a preparation for Shabbos. Yeah? In other words, the Mishkan that we build during the week is elevated on the Shabbos. Whatever happens during the week is elevated on Shabbos. The more we put into the weekday, the more we're able to get out of Shabbos. That's the process. That's how the 6 days come before Shabbos. So Shabbos, as it says in Kabbalah, is like a completion, it's an elevation, it's a culmination of everything that happened during the week. At the same time, Shabbos, the Zohar says that Shabbos gives bracha to the coming week. Right? So that we have that aspect every Shabbos. Shabbos is a hemshech, it's a continuation of the previous week. Shabbos is something that gives a bracha to the coming week. And that's the same idea. Every Shabbos has these two aspects, where it's something that comes after the 6 days, it's something that comes before the 6 days. And those two aspects of Shabbos are hinted in these two times Shabbos comes up in these parshas, where in Parshas Kisiso it comes at the end of the Mishkan, Parshas Vayakal comes before the Mishkan. Okay? Good? So that's the introduction to the parsha. Then the parsha continues. Vayomer Moshe, if you got Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Right? Vayomer Moshe El Adas B'nei Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Jewish people, Ze Hadavar, this is the thing Asher Tziva Hashem Loimer, that Hashem has commanded. Chu Me'itchem, you should take from yourselves Truma LaHashem, a separation for Hashem. Kol and Divliber, all those that donate their services. Yivi'ah, Eish Trumas Hashem should bring the separation of Hashem, Zov, Kesef, and Choshes, gold, silver, copper, and it starts to enumerate all the things. And then essentially, the rest of Ayakal, as I said, is just a repetition of Truma Tetzaveh. Just goes through every one of the vessels again of the Mishkan, how they built it, how they did it, how they constructed it, and just repeats it. Then we go to Parshas Pekudei. Page 530. The beginning of Parshas Pekudei is very much the same, but what's specific about Parshas Pekudei is that Parshas Pekudei also is an audit. It's an audit of all the material that came in to the Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu gives a complete, thorough audit of everything that took place, which is an amazing lesson in itself, the idea of transparency, that Moshe Rabbeinu had to remain above suspicion, even though no one really suspected him, but even Moshe Rabbeinu had to give an account of everything that was happening. And that happens, and then we read all about how it was all done, and how it was all accounted for, etc. And how also we read in Pekudei how all the garments of the Kohanim were made, the tzitz, the forehead, the head plate, the breastplate, the apron, etc., etc. Sorry? All repetition, yeah. Then we come to Peiret Mem, chapter 40 on page 536. Well, Hashem now is also finished, and Hashem now begins to talk about the actual construction of the Mishkan, when it should be put up. So let's have a look a little bit at the Pesukim. It says, Vayedaber Hashem o Moshe Leimer. Hashem said to Moshe, saying, Vayoyim HaChodesh HaRishon. And here we see an amazing connection between this week's Parsha and the Shabbos that we're going to be experiencing. 536, yeah? Perek Mem Pasuk Aleph, chapter 40, verse 1. Vayoyim HaChodesh HaRishon. In the first month on the first day, i.e. Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which is next Tuesday, Tokim es Mishkan Oyel Moed. That's the day you should actually put up the new Mishkan. Right? In other words, the new Mishkan was put up just under a year after the Jewish people left Mitzrayim. Left Mitzrayim Rosh Pesach, which is the 15th of Nisan. And the Mishkan was put up the second year after them going out of Egypt, 2 weeks earlier, or Rosh Chodesh Nisan, 2 weeks before Pesach. Yeah? And he gives them exactly instructions how to take place. And then if you have a look at Pasuk, where is it? Pasuk Yud Zayin, 17, the next page, 538. It says, Vayihi b'chodesh harishon. It was in the first day, the first month, sorry, which is Nisan. Bashana hasheni is the second year, meaning the second year after the Jews left Egypt. Ve'echad l'chodesh, on the first of the month, hukam hamishkan. The Mishkan was put up. Right? The next pasuk says, Vayokom Moshe es hamishkan, vayiter es Adonai Moshe Rabbeinu put up the Mishkan. And he placed the sockets, Vayasim as crusher of the beams, Vayitir as brichot, put the bolts, Vayakim as amudim, put up the pillars, etc., etc. So it's interesting, Rashi points out, right, that in the first pasuk it says, the Mishkan was put up. The next pasuk says, Moshe Rabbeinu put it up. So it doesn't say on the first of the month of Nisan, Moshe Rabbeinu put up the Mishkan, it says it was put up. Right? And the second one it says, Moshe Rabbeinu put it up. Now the truth also is that actually this wasn't the first time the Mishkan was put up. We read later on in Vayikra that there was 7 days practice. There were 7 days where the Mishkan went up every day and came down every day, where they had to, yeah, for 7 days before Rosh Chodesh Nisan.
So on Shabbos?
Yeah, probably including Shabbos. I'll tell you why in a second. Because once the Mishkan was up, we talked about this last week, once the Mishkan was up, they brought sacrifices. Right? They brought sacrifices and korbanos. That was not even on Shabbos. And we talked about this last week. Why? But that to be a 7 day practice. The purpose of that practice wasn't so much for the Mishkan. The purpose of that practice was more to get Aaron and his sons used to bringing sacrifices. Right, so every day went up, but Moshe Rabbeinu was the Kohen, and he would show them how to shecht the animals, how to offer the sacrifice, how to bring the incense, how to light the menorah, etc. But then finally, in Rosh Chodesh Nisan was actually the mitzvah of putting up the Mishkan. Here we find a fascinating thing: the mitzvah of putting up the Mishkan was a mitzvah given to Moshe Rabbeinu. He was the one who was supposed to put up the Mishkan. The problem is, when it came the first of Nisan, for the first 7 days he had help. People put it up with him. Because the first 7 days wasn't actually a mitzvah to put up the Mishkan, the mitzvah was more just to get Aaron and his sons ready to bring the korbanos. When it came Rosh Chodesh Nisan, right, it was suddenly a mitzvah for Moshe Rabbeinu to put up the Mishkan. And he couldn't do it, it was too heavy. It's a huge structure. Because we've learned in the first pasuk of this chapter that Hashem says to him on the first day of Nisan, you shall put up the Mishkan. It's like it's your mitzvah. And in fact, we know that the Mishkan is called the Mishkan of Moshe Rabbeinu. He was the one to build it. He was the one to oversee it. And he was the one ultimately to put it up. So, how's one, even though he was very tall, Moshe Rabbeinu, it's true. But nevertheless, we're talking about a huge structure. I mean, these things were like 10 amos. They were like 5 meters high, these beams. They were thick beams. Right? So how's he supposed to do it himself? That's why the pasuk says on the first day of the month, Hukam HaMishkan. The Mishkan was put up. Not that he put it up, it was put up. It kind of happened on its own. Hashem, he took it, but miraculously Hashem put it up with him. And that's what Rashi says. It actually just happened miraculously. As he picked up each beam, it kind of fell into place. So he was doing it, and Hashem was helping him, but it was his job. Okay? And that happened on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Now, of course, what was the significance of Rosh Chodesh Nisan? Right? Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the first day of Nisan, is an incredibly important day. Because a year before that, although the Jewish people had not left Mitzrayim until the 15th of Nisan, but a year before that, the Jewish people were given their first mitzvah. The mitzvah of making a calendar and the mitzvah of bringing Korban Pesach. That mitzvah was given to them on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. The Medrash says, and that's of course the connection to this week's Parsha and this week's Shabbos, because we read that special Parsha, the Parsha of HaChodesh, we read this week, and I'm going to explain that in a second. The Medrash says that the month of Nisan is a significant month. It says that when Hashem created the world, He chose the month of Tishrei to be the month of creation. However, when he chose Yaakov and his sons to be his nation, He chose the month of Nisan to be the month of redemption. Right? In other words, the month of Tishrei represents creation. Creation, we know, is a miraculous event, but it's an event with limitations. So Hashem created an existence with nature, a cycle of nature, where everything is kind of trapped in this in the natural cycle of how the world functions. Right? However, when He chose Jewish people as a nation, He chose the month of Nisan to be the month of Geula, the month of redemption. What does redemption mean? Redemption means doesn't mean only a physical, geographical relocation from Mitzrayim elsewhere. It means the concept of becoming liberated, becoming free. An idea of being able to go beyond the natural limitations of this world, right? Or the natural limitations of ourselves. To be free means we're able to control ourselves and overcome our own limitations and our own disposition, right? So the concept of freedom was actually created on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, a year before that, right? It was a year before that where Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu on Rosh Chodesh Nisan and said, the moment has arrived, the month of redemption has arrived. They weren't actually free till 2 weeks later, but the concept of redemption was born on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and that's when Hashem said to him, this is the month you have to bring the Korban Pesach, this is the month for you to make a calendar, this is the month I choose you as a nation. Right? And that's why a year later, the Mishkan was actually put up on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, because that was like the ultimate of the connection to Hashem, was be able to create a Mishkan which would be a place where Hashem could rest, and that was almost like a culmination of the redemption of Mitzrayim, and that's what happened on the anniversary of the first mitzvah. Now, let's talk about this first mitzvah, because as we said, this is the special parasha we read the Shabbos, right? So we know, just to summarize, and I want to just explain this a bit, this time of the year, we read 4 special parshas. In addition to the Seder of the Week, there are 4 Shabbosim where we read 4 extra pieces, right? 2 before Purim, 2 after Purim. So, 2 before Purim, we read, the first one was the mitzvah of giving half a shekel. Then, the Shabbos before Purim, read the parsha of Amalek, the Zachar, to remember Amalek. Then, sometime after Purim, we read the Parshas Parah, the Parsha of the Red Heifer, becoming pure. And then we finally read the Parsha on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, or the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Nisan, we read the Parsha of HaChodesh, the Parsha where Hashem chooses us as a nation, essentially, and gives us the mitzvah of a calendar and the mitzvah of Korban Pesach.
Can you just repeat that again? You said twice a year, reading the 2
books. No. I said there are 4 special extra portions.
Right.
That we read around this time of the year. 2 before Purim, 2 after Purim. Right? And they're always known, although they're not specifically connected, although we see they are, they're always known as the 4 parshias. Right? The Arba parshias, the 4 parshias. And they're kind of always lumped together. Although, historically and halachically, there's different reasons why we read the different parshias, but they're always lumped together. They're known as the 4 special parshias. Right? Which, by the way, they're not always, in fact, they're never always, on 4 consecutive Shabbosim. Okay? They're called the 4 parshas, but they're always read over a span of 5 or 6 weeks. And I'll explain why, because it's relevant to the concept I want to share with you. because there's certain times that each one must be read. For example, the first one, Shekolim, about the half a shekel, must be read either on the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Adar, and the Shabbos, or the Shabbos of Rosh Chodesh Adar, depending on when Shabbos comes out, right? Zachor must be read on the Shabbos before Purim. Now that means sometimes, therefore, between Shekel and Zachor, there's a week break, like as happened this year, right? Normally it happens that way. Not always, but that's where the calendar works out, right? Because the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Adar is when we read half a shekel, and then the Shabbos before Purim was 2 weeks later, right? The last two also have a special halachic structure. Now, what are the last two? Let's just understand this. The last two are the Parsha of Parah Adumah, the red heifer, as we read last week, right? And then the Parsha HaChodesh. Why do we read around this time of the year? Because this time of the year is a time where Jews historically would get ready to bring the Korban Pesach, right? 2 weeks before Pesach, they would start to, or the beginning of Rosh Chodesh Nisan, they would start to get ready to bring the Korban Pesach. Yeah? Part of the component of bringing the Korban Pesach is you had to be pure. If you had come into contact with a dead body and you weren't pure, you couldn't participate in the Korban Pesach. So therefore, around this time of the year, firstly, Jews would get warned about the Parah Adumah. They would always warn people, guys, it's time to, if you're impure, to make sure to get the ashes and the water of the Parah Adumah sprinkled on you so you should become pure. And secondly, you should do that because it's time to just get ready for the Korban Pesach, go get your animal, make sure it's perfect, make sure there's no blemishes, and get ready for all of this, right? Now, okay, so that's the two structures. Now, when we actually read this parasha, is like this. In the Talmud Yerushalmi, you know, there's two Talmuds, right? There's the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmud. In Talmud Yerushalmi, we find an interesting dispute. Everyone agrees that this last one, the one of the Chodesh, the one of Korban Pesach, should be read on the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Nisan, or the Shabbos of Rosh Chodesh Nisan, depending when it comes out. Okay, so this year, it should be this Shabbos. The question is, when should the one of the red cow be read? Okay. Now, why is that a question? See, this year, Purim came out on a Sunday, right? So it happens to be that there's only two more Shabbosim in the month. You understand? So, Purim's on a Sunday, so therefore we got last Shabbos. We read the one about the Parah Adumah. And then this coming Shabbos, we're reading about the HaChodesh, and that's the only two Shabbosim available to us. But it doesn't always work like that. Sometimes after Purim, you've got three Shabbos into the month. Because Purim could sometimes come on a Friday, for example. When Purim comes on a Friday, right, you've actually got three more options. So then the question is, we know that out of those three, HaChodesh, this week's one, is going to be on the last one, right? Should Parah Adumah be on the Shabbos right after Purim? Or should it be just before HaChodesh? Okay. Yeah, that's the question. That's spoken about in Talmud Yerushalmi. So in the Talmud Yerushalmi, it brings two opinions. One opinion is that if that happens, do the Parah Adumah, do the red cow one right after Purim. Why? Because you're ready within 30 days of Pesach. Historically, people already started getting ready for the halachas of Pesach. So get straight into it. Right? Do it right away. The laws of purity and impurity, laws of Parah Adumah, and finished. Go for it. Yeah? Then take a week break. And then when it's time for Korban Pesach, which is Shabbos Mevarchim Nisan, or Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Nisan, then you read the one of HaChodesh. Yeah? That's one opinion. That's the opinion we don't follow. Okay? The opinion we do follow, okay, that's relevant to what I want to share with you. The opinion we do follow says like this. Let me just get you the words. Very interesting. It comes from a rabbi, Reb Levi, in the name of Reb Chisda Bar Chanina or something. And he says, no, you never make a break between the Parah Adumah and the Korban Pesach one. You must not make a break. In other words, work out when you're going to read HaChodesh, which is this week's, and then make sure the Shabbos before is Parah Adumah. Even if that means you're skipping a Shabbos after Purim. Okay? That's what he says. And that's what we do. We always, Parah Adumah and Chodesh always comes together. But the fascinating thing is, he says in the Yerushalmi, I'm going to give you a way to remember this. He says, it's just like the Seder night. That the Seder night between the third cup of wine and the fourth cup of wine, you can't make any break. What does that mean? We have four parshas, right? We talk about four parshas. On Seder night, we also have four cups of wine. The halacha is, although we don't do this, the minhag is not to do this, but intrinsically the halacha is that between the first cup of wine and the second cup of wine, if you're thirsty and if you're crazy enough to drink more wine than four cups of wine, you can have a simple wine. You can have a lachaim between the first cup of wine and the second cup of wine, if you want to, right? You don't have to make sure they're consecutive. The minhag is not to do that. We don't do that. We say the haggadah, we don't interrupt. Between the second cup of wine and the third cup of wine, also, you can drink if you want to. In fact, the halacha is, there's not even a minhag not to. Again, you've got to be nuts to have wine during the meal if you're having four cups of wine, but halachically you can. Right? If you want to wash down the fish with a bit of wine, gezut tahet. Then the halacha is, sorry?
Yeah, you can't use water.
You could, but I say someone wants to drink wine, doesn't like water. Right? But let's say the halacha is, if a person wants to drink between the third cup and the fourth cup, that you can't do. It says, ben gimel ledalad, between the third and the fourth cup, lo yafsi, cannot make any interruption. There cannot be other wine between, there cannot be a space, so to speak, between the third wine and the fourth wine. They've got to flow and connect one into the other. Yeah? So Reb Levi here says, that's the way you remember this halacha of Paraduma as well. We have four parshas, four special portions that we read this time of the year. Right? Paraduma is the third one. HaChodesh, which is the calendar, and Korban Pesach is the fourth one. Yeah? Between the third and the fourth, you cannot make a break. There can be a Shabbos break between one and two. There can be a Shabbos break between two and three. But there cannot be a Shabbos break between three and four, just like there cannot be interruption between the third cup and the fourth cup. Nice concept. But obviously, the obvious question is, what is the connection between the four parshas and the four cups of wine? I mean, it's a nice thing for us to remember, just like a comparison. But the Gemara doesn't do that. I mean, it's a nice thing, we're just talking about semantics, but when the Gemara connects them that way, there obviously has got to be a deeper connection. It doesn't just mean that just like you can't drink wine between third cup and fourth cup, you can't make a Shabbos break between this parasha and that parasha. It's not such a hard halacha to remember that you need some sort of comparison, that you need kind of a whole way to remember it. You don't need a code. It's very simple. Just say that, you know, whenever you read HaChadosh, make sure the Shabbos before is the one about the red cow. You don't need a whole thing for it. The fact that he connected the four cups must mean that there's some intrinsic connection between these four concepts. So the many explanations, I'll show it to you a beautiful one that's based on the Maharal, and then extrapolated by other commentaries in the Maharal that sort of take it forward. Let's have a look at this whole idea why you cannot drink between the third cup of wine and the fourth cup of wine. So if you have a look, why do we have four cups of wine? If you have a look on Parshas Va'era, right? This is a bit of Pesach insights now. What we're learning now is good for the Shabbos, also good for the Seder night. So you can use whatever you want. Page 318. We know that we have four cups of wine on Pesach night. The primary reason, there are many reasons why we have four cups of wine. The primary and most famous reason, the Gemara says, why we have four cups of wine is corresponding to the four expressions of redemption that Hashem used when he took us out of Mitzrayim, right? What are they? Let's have a look. It's in Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Lachain Emor. Therefore, Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Emor livene Yisrael, say to the Jewish people, Ani Hashem, I am God. Vayitzeisi eschem mitachas sivlois Mitzrayim. I will take you out from the burdens of Mitzrayim. Vihitzalti eschem avodasim. I will save you from slavery. Vegoalti eschem. I will redeem you. Bizroya natuya, with an outstretched arm, with shvatim gedolim, and with great judgment. Okay. Then he says, Velakachti eschem li la'am. I will take you for a nation, and I will take you for you. I'll be for you for a God, right? And you will know, I am your God. I will take you out from the burdens of Mitzrayim. So these are the four expressions of Geula. I will take you out. I will save you. I will redeem you, and I will take you for a nation. Yep. If you have a look, you can see an interesting thing. The pasuk puts the first three in one pasuk, and the last one in a separate pasuk. You realize that? Okay. Why? Because if you analyze them, you'll see they're very different. The first three talk about what Hashem is, he's taking us out of Egypt. In other words, the emphasis on the first three expressions are going away from Egypt. I will redeem you out of Egypt. I will save you from Egypt. I will take you out of slavery. The fourth one is not about running away from Egypt. It's about connecting to God. See that? V'lakachti eschem lilem, I'll take you for a nation. Says the Maharal like this. To become God's nation, to become free, is a process. And generally speaking, it's a two-part process. Because we know that you cannot become something else if you're not willing to shed your previous existence. We've spoken about this before, right? You have to distance yourself from the negative in order to become connected to the positive. You have to go away from where you are in order to connect to something different. We know this when Moshe Rabbeinu stood at the burning bush, the very, very first revelation that Moses had at the burning bush, right? So there's a famous line there. When Moshe Rabbeinu sees the fire, he sees the bush that's burning, and miraculously it's burning, but it's not being consumed, and he's all amazed, right? And the pasuk says like this, the pasuk says there, Asura na ve'era. Moshe Rabbeinu says, I will, let me go away and have a look what's going on there. So Rashi says four great words. It's an unbelievable line Rashi says over there. Rashi says, Asura mikan lehiskarev lesham. Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, let me go away from here so that I can become closer to there. Right? Whatever Rashi means, a separate issue, but it's an unbelievable line. In other words, in order for me to become closer there, I have to go away from where I am here. Right? And that's a general principle in connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in becoming free, in graduating, in promoting ourselves to a whole new existence. In order to become Hashem's nation, you have to leave Mitzrayim. Right? Every one of us has our Mitzrayim. Every one of us has our personal Mitzrayim. We have our challenges, we have the rough parts of our personality, we have those character issues that prevent us from growing, that imprison us, that bind us, that trap us, etc. Right? In order to become connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in order to become free, we must be willing to move away from them. We must be willing to go beyond that personality. We must be willing to get rid of the slave mentality that we have, that mentality that we trapped in what we're doing. Okay? And says the Maharal that the first, that saying goodbye to slavery is a hard process. It's very, very difficult. Right? And it takes the stages. And we're going to see what those stages are in a second when we talk about the four parshiyos. But, right? And why it's in number three. But it's hard. It's hard to say goodbye to something difficult. But then says the Maharal a very important thing. When a person, it can take a long time to distance yourself from a negative part of your personality. It can take a long time to get rid of slavery or the slave mentality. But then you have to be very, very careful. Because when you eventually succeed, says the Maharal, in shedding the negative, there, all of a sudden, it becomes incredibly urgent not to leave a vacuum. You've got to replace it with something. Because a person cannot function in a vacuum. A person must be filled with some drive. That's the way Hashem created the person. A person must be filled with some drive, with some accomplishment, with some achievement. Right? Not abstaining from something, but not replacing it with something positive, is very detrimental to the human experience. You know, it's a little bit like Shabbos. I've talked about this before. Shabbos, you say goodbye to the week. There's the Shamor of Shabbos and the Zachor, right? You know what I'm talking about? There's the abstaining from what you do during the week. It's saying goodbye to the week. And then there's the positive of Shabbos, right? There are people that don't know, they don't have any taste of the experience of Shabbos. However, there are people that do and find it an incredibly negative experience. Why? Because this is the mistake they've made. There are people that keep Shabbos and find it incredibly negative for the reason that they actually said goodbye to the week but never said hello to Shabbos. They actually never encountered Shabbos. They said goodbye to what they're used to doing and didn't replace it with anything. The whole idea of Shabbos is that you say goodbye to the week and you replace it with a whole new spiritual experience. To say goodbye to what you used to doing during the week, as mundane, as materialistic as it is, but then to leave a vacuum and not replace it with anything, it's worse in a way. I'm not talking about halachically worse, because halachically it's not. I mean, if you sleep in bed all day and you find that it's still keeping Shabbos, and technically. But I'm talking about spiritually and the experience of Shabbos, right? It's worse in a way than being involved in weekday. The experience is much worse. The bitterness is much worse. The disappointment is much worse. And that's why we find that sometimes people have such a negative attitude towards Shabbos. They find it such a burden, such an imposition. Because they're keeping Shabbos on the level of saying goodbye to the week, but never replacing it with anything. So that's just an example of how that works in Shabbos, right? If you say goodbye during the week and then you leave that, you use that vacuum immediately to replace it with a higher experience, with a kiddush, with a davening, with a Shabbos, whatever, each person on their own level, right? And that's a whole different experience. Says the Maharal, that's true in general of the human development. You can, every person has to, every redemption, every personal experience of freedom has two parts to it. You've got to say goodbye to the slavery, you've got to say goodbye to the negative, and you've got to embrace something positive. But when you've managed to successfully say goodbye to the negative, there has to be an immediate embracement of the positive. If you leave space in between, you finish. You'll replace it with something even more negative.
Isn't a bit of the... I always looked at it like this, maybe it's not, that the behaviour of Bnei Israel in the wilderness that got them to the point where they were building golden calves and all that, they have left. They were in a vacuum as such, so they didn't really have that much... They had guidelines, but not a lot. And then they sort of got themselves busy in the wrong things rather than...
Okay, maybe. And because maybe... Well, no, they left Mitzrayim and right away embraced the positive. That was the idea of Matan Torah, right? But maybe there were some flaws in the way they embraced the positive. Maybe that's why those flaws, on one level, could have had them fail later. And that's why it's a lifelong experience to be able to embrace that positive properly. But the model was certainly there of leaving Mitzrayim and embracing the positive. Says the Maharal, that's the depth of the halacha. It's a beautiful concept. That's the depth of the halacha. That between the third cup and the fourth cup, you cannot make any break. You cannot interrupt. Because you're leaving a vacuum. The first three cups, yeah, you can be interruption. Because the first three cups is all one process. The process of saying goodbye to the negative. It's, I'll save you from Mitzrayim. I'll redeem you from Mitzrayim. I'll take you out of Mitzrayim. It's all about shedding the personality of the negative. But if you successfully do that, then don't wait. As soon as you successfully do that, what are you leaving Mitzrayim for? Where's your goal? Where are you going to? You've left Mitzrayim, but where are you going? To leave Mitzrayim and then to wander aimlessly with no goal, that's a disaster. Right? It's better to be back in Mitzrayim.
I don't even think you can really do it. Like, if you are trying to shed a bad character trait or leave your Mitzrayim, like, it doesn't even make sense that you're not going to be doing the opposite of what you have been doing.
No, it doesn't, you're right. In theory, it doesn't make sense. Unfortunately, you do find a lot of times people do that. They know something is wrong, they'll control negative behavior, but they actually don't replace it with something positive. And that you find that with the example of Shabbos I gave you, but you find that even in the character development of someone. Someone will say, okay, I'll give you a simple example of personal development, right? Someone who's very busy in getting rid of negative things, like they're not going to overindulge in eating, they're not going to become angry, they're not going to hit, right? But they haven't actually channeled themselves to be, what is my focus in life? So what am I doing positive for the human world? What am I doing to help people? What am I doing to love people? What am I doing to replace it, right? A person must, you have to replace it with something. You can't live in a vacuum. You can't live in, I'm not going to do something. Right? And spiritually, it's for sure like that. Exactly. Because keep falling back, or you replace it with something even more negative. Or you fall into even a more negative track, because a person cannot remain in a vacuum. And spiritually speaking, it's even more so because leaving Mitzrayim has no purpose. The purpose was not to leave Mitzrayim, the purpose was to connect to God. So you left Mitzrayim, right? It's like a famous thing, you know, Shalachas Ami, let my people go, right? That slogan was a very famous slogan, but it was always missing one word, right? The last word of the pasuk. Shalach es amis, let my people go, v'yavduni, and they will serve me. Right? That was the word that was always missing. Shalach es amis, v'yavduni, my people go, but for a purpose. There's a destination. There's not just.
There was never a question when they asked that, and that was the first request from Paro. There's never sort of a question, why do you have to go there and worship? Why can't you do it here?
Okay, because you need to, because you can't worship in Mitzrayim, but leave Mitzrayim before you can worship. But says the Maharal's point is, when you leave Mitzrayim, don't forget to right away replace with the positive, right? And that's why after the third cup, you have to go right away to the fourth cup. So
does that also mean if you don't exactly know what you're leaving, you don't know where you're going?
Oh, for sure. Okay, that's a whole other, exactly. You have to know what you're leaving first, of course. And that's, you've got to know what you're saying goodbye to in order to say hello to something else. That's true. But the point here is that if you know that, once you've got there ready, the point is you've got to embrace something positive right away. That's a very, very important idea.
It's an amazing wisdom.
Right. Now let's take it to the four parashas before we leave. Okay. So based on this maral, the mafreshim explain like this. The same thing is with the four parashas, the four portions that we read this year. So one of the mafreshim I saw explains in the following. The parasha we're going to read this Shabbos is the embracing of the positive. Because this is the parasha where Hashem makes us a nation. Right? He gives us the first mitzvah. In fact, you know, the first Rashi in the Chumash says that the Torah should have begun with the parasha that we're going to read this parasha. I'm talking about the special parasha. HaChodesh Zelachem, right? It's so important. When Hashem said, this is the month, that's the month of redemption and you should bring Korban Pesach, this is the parasha of connection to Hashem. What is the first three parshias? We said the first one is half a shekel, Amalek, and the red cow. That's the first three cups. That's leaving the negative. One of the ways to explain it is like this. Why do we need three things to read to leave the negative? So we know that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that there are three negative character traits that destroy a person. Right? Jealousy, lust, and honor. Pursuit of glory, correct? Kina, taiva, and kovod. Those are the three most, if you want to sum up the destruction of human being, it's those three things, right? Jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory. So, the Medrash says that the mitzvah of half a shekel is to atone for the selling of Yosef. Because apparently what happened was, when they sold Yosef, they sold him for money, right? Each one of the 10 tribes received half a shekel. That was the share. Right? To atone for that, we have the mitzvah of half a shekel. That's what one explanation. What is the basis? What is the basis of the Mechiras Yosef? What is the basis of selling Yosef? Jealousy. Right? So Parsha Shkolim is saying goodbye to jealousy. Sorry?
No, I'm just...
Yeah? Zohar is about remembering Amalek. Mepharshim say, and it's based on words in the Pasuk, that the nation of Amalek, among many, many things, represented sexual depravity, immorality. Right? Therefore, Amalek is saying goodbye to lust. Parah is saying goodbye to the ego, saying goodbye to honor. What is Parah? Parah is purification, coming into contact with a dead body. It's about death. Right? Why did death come into the world? Because Adam Arishan ate from the tree of knowledge. What was the idea of eating from the tree of knowledge? He had everything in the world, right? He needed that tree, dafka, right? Why? Because it was ego. Because the nachash, the serpent said, if you eat from that knowledge, you'll be like Hashem. It was the pursuit of power, the pursuit of being knowledgeable. So the first three parshas are the involvement in saying goodbye to negativity, saying goodbye to the three most fundamental destructive behaviors.
What's the first parsha again? Sorry.
Shkolim, that's jealousy, right? Because it atones for the process. Comes along Reb Levi and says, yes, the fourth one, Hachodesh, is about connecting to Hashem. First three is about saying goodbye to the negative. The fourth one is about connecting to Hashem. Therefore, you must make sure that between the third and the fourth is no Shabbos break. Just like, it's not just a play on words, just like between the third cup and the fourth cup there's no break, between the third parsha and the fourth parsha there's no break. It's the same idea. Just like the first three expressions of redemption are about saying goodbye to Mitzrayim, and the fourth one is about saying hello to Hashem, embracing the positive. And the concept that Maharal explained to us is that that's where the most vulnerable moment is, when you leave a vacuum, when you're not doing anything, when you've said goodbye to the negative but you haven't yet embraced the positive. That is the most dangerous moment in human development. And therefore between the third and the fourth, don't make any break. Because from the third one, from successfully saying goodbye to the negative, you must jump right away into embracing the positive. Otherwise there's that vulnerable vacuum that's left. Similarly, the first three parshas that we read around this time of the year are also about saying goodbye to the negative. And HaChodesh is about embracing the positive. And therefore between the third parsha and the fourth parsha, you can't make any break. There cannot be a Shabbos in between. You must right away embrace the positive. And that's the preparation to Pesach.
Shaya. That's really good.
Okay.
All the pieces in the